From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. He used to play straight arrows in B-films. Now he plays inept straight arrows in parodies of B-films. On today's holiday edition of Fresh Air, we talk with actor and self-described square, Leslie Nielsen. Also, satirist Harry Shearer on his long career before he became a satirist. We'll hear about his days as a child actor on The Jack Benny Show, Leave It to Beaver, and in the film Abbott and Costello Go to Mars. And world music commentator Milo Miles pays tribute to the late Bahamian guitarist and singer Joseph Spence. His recordings have been reissued. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton is back in the nation's capital after spending the day in South Florida examining the ongoing recovery effort from Hurricane Andrew. Doug Phillips reports from Miami.
During walking tours of hard-hit neighborhoods in Homestead and Florida City, Mr. Clinton saw firsthand that 1 year after Hurricane Andrew, recovery has come a long way, but still has a long way to go. The president told one Homestead audience that the federal government is committed to being a full partner in the rebuilding effort.
We will not have our work done until everybody in this part of our country who wants a job has one, until people are back in their homes, until these communities are rebuilt.
South Florida has so far received some $3 billion in hurricane recovery funds from the federal government. Surveying South Florida's progress, Mr. Clinton said victims of this summer's flooding in the Midwest should take heart because they, too, can count on the government's help. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Phillips in Miami.
A spokesman for the president's health care reform team pledged today that existing health benefits provided by employers will remain tax-free. The administration plan would put a ceiling on new health care benefits, taxing any benefits that exceed that limit. The tax money would be used to help pay for the plan. Spokesman Kevin Anderson said that ceiling won't apply to existing benefits and that employers will be able to gain permanent tax exemptions for the health benefits they already provide. Anderson said the promise to exempt existing benefits is a recognition that many unions gave up pay raises in exchange for health benefits. PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat has returned to Cairo for consultations on the proposed accord with Israel on limited Palestinian self-rule. Arafat's stop in Egypt follows a trip to Damascus, where he got limited Syrian support for the plan, but was snubbed by rival Palestinian officials. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Upon his arrival in Cairo, PLO leader Yasser Arafat described his talks with Syrian President Hafez al-Assad as brotherly. Assad yesterday announced he wouldn't oppose the Gaza-Jericho plan as long as it had the Palestinians' backing. But Arafat did not comment on the refusal of hardline Palestinian leaders to meet with the PLO chairman in Damascus today. The Syrian-based Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine are the largest Palestinian blocs after Arafat's own Fatah faction. The radical groups remain fiercely opposed to the proposal, saying it gives Israel too many concessions and doesn't guarantee a Palestinian state. Arafat is due to stay in Cairo for several days, holding talks with top Egyptian officials. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Cairo.
A jury in West Palm Beach, Florida, is considering the case against two white men charged with abducting a black tourist and setting him afire. This is NPR. A small group of wounded Muslim civilians was evacuated today from the besieged city of Mostar after being delayed for days because of heavy fighting between Muslims and Croats. 14 adults and one child were taken to a Bosnian government-held town in central Bosnia. UN relief officials said Muslim refugees in the Bosnian town of Jablanica said they were tortured, beaten, and starved in Croatian-run prisons. The refugees were said to be without food or shelter in the town on the road between Mostar and Sarajevo. In Canada, Prime Minister Kim Campbell is expected to announce federal elections tomorrow or Wednesday. The vote is likely to be set for October 25th and will determine whether the ruling Progressive Conservatives will win a third term. Jennifer Ludden reports.
Kim Campbell took over as Progressive Conservative Party leader in June,
Since then, she's lifted the popularity of her party, which polls show now ranks closely behind the opposition liberals. Still, Campbell faces public resentment of past conservative policies, which have increased taxes and supported free trade with the United States and Mexico. Campbell has reduced the number of cabinet ministers and merged some federal departments as part of her plan to eliminate the country's deficit within 5 years. While Campbell has pushed the need to lower the deficit, her opponent, Liberal Party leader Jean Chrétien, said Canada's high unemployment must be addressed first. Chrétien has criticized the North American Free Trade Agreement and promised to finance government work programs to create jobs. For National Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Ludden reporting.
The yearly muscular dystrophy telethon ended about a half hour ago, and host Jerry Lewis says the event garnered a record $46 million in pledges. Critics say Lewis raises money by exploiting viewers' pity for people with muscular dystrophy. This year, he made an effort to focus on the achievements of people with MD. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Leslie Nielsen has become famous for parroting the kind of role he played for real during most of his career. Now he's best known as the incredibly stupid Lieutenant Frank Drebin in the cop film spoof Naked Gun. He first worked with the Naked Gun team on the disaster film parody Airplane, in which he played the doctor. Of course, he was in the real disaster film, The Poseidon Adventure. He's played more than his share of cops, pilots, and captains in his over 60 movies and hundreds of TV shows, including The New Breed, Forbidden Planet, and who can forget Tammy and The Bachelor. In his new book, The Naked Truth, Nielsen tells an uncensored, uninhibited, and totally made-up version of his life. Here's an excerpt of his audio version of the book.
I'm an extremely fortunate person. I've been honored by my colleagues with 4 Academy Award nominations. I've twice been named Best Actor. I've won 2 People's Choice Awards, a Golden Globe, a Best in Show at Westminster, an American League batting title. I've been a 3-time finalist in the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. I was named Mr. Week of April 23rd on Home Shopping Network. And finally, in August 1990, I received the highest honor any actor could be given, other than participation in gross receipts. I was awarded the coveted Nobel Prize for Good Acting.
You've become famous for lampooning square, mediocre actors in B-movie formulas.
Yeah, well, it's not really becoming famous for lampooning those kind of actors. I'm really lampooning myself, and I'm pretty square. And I'm pretty dumb, and I'm pretty stupid, too.
Well, this all started for you with Airplane. How were you chosen as one of the actors in Airplane?
I think that David and Jerry Zucker and Jim Abrams, who were the authors and the creators, directors, etc. of Airplane, they had written something that was just wonderfully dumb and funny. And they knew that if Peter Graves and Lloyd Bridges and Robert Stack and myself, they had seen our work on television, and if we approached their material with the same seriousness and the same gravity with which we approached our police work television show that we were doing, that it would be very funny. And when I read the script, I knew exactly what they were after, and it was the greatest, advent or break of my life in a sense, but I ended up working with people who spotted me for being the closet comedian that I was. And from there came Police Squad and Naked Gun and on from there. And they just kept on. I was a closet comedian, and they kept on knocking on my door.
Had you ever done comedy before?
Well, yeah, I was always doing comedy behind the camera. And I had done one MASH maybe 5 or 6 years before Airplane, which was funny. It was called The Ring Banger. And it plays frequently, but the thing is that there was a episode in TV, and Airplane was a very successful motion picture, and it was significant enough that I did become seen and associated with comedy and with being able to do it. So it was the launching of the nut that is inside of Nielsen. Thank God for it.
What were the roles in your career that seemed closest to the kinds of roles that you've since parodied?
I think the body of my work. I think The New Breed, for example. I began years ago when I would watch these police action dramas that I did, and I would sit there and watch myself and laugh uproariously at what I was doing. And then I began to laugh at my peers. I laughed at Robert Stack and the Untouchables, and it just all became so funny. And that's when I began laughing at the material in general. That's when I began slanting my eyes very strongly toward doing comedy. And I got lucky and had a chance to make that break.
Well, tell us about your role as the cop in The New Breed in 1961.
The New Breed, Lieutenant Adams. Adams seems to be a name that has pursued me. I played Commander Adams in Forbidden Planet. But the motto of the squad room was "No fat cops stealing apples." In other words, the true arrow, straight, stand up. Cops on what they called the Metropolitan Squad, which is really an actual squad in the LAPD. So these were the guys, this squad, who were called upon to rush to whatever breach in the line there was, and they would function in every department.
Let's get to your role as the space commander in Forbidden Planet.
Okay.
Tell us about that role for people who haven't seen the movie.
The role? People, Forbidden Planet, it seems
everybody's seen Forbidden Planet.
It seems to play a couple of times a year, and it has for the last 35 years. It's amazing. And the story, it stands up today as well as it did back 35 years ago. But, another straight arrow. He was a commander of the spaceship, Bellerophon, and lands on Altair 4. It could have been the pilot for Star Trek. It was the forerunner of Captain Kirk and of Star Wars and all the science fiction films today.
You said that you used to do a lot of comedy behind the camera.
Yeah.
Did you satirize the films that you were in?
Sure. If they were, worth satirizing. I remember working with Bill Conrad when he was doing Canon. And so when you're working off camera or when an actor is having a close-up, you usually, if you're in the scene, you'll stand alongside of the camera, and so that the actor has somebody to look at, and the actual person they're going to be working with or do work with in the scene. I remember standing alongside the camera, and Bill said, "What are you doing there?" I said, "Well, I'm just, professional courtesy. You don't want to talk to empty air." He says, "Are you kidding? That's where I put the prompter, the cards. I'm going to be looking at the cards there. I don't want you standing there." He says, "You don't think I spent any time memorizing this baloney, do you?" And so that was the attitude, That's the show. That's how he approached the show. That's how he did it. I know that any number of actors who use prompters that are around and don't bother to memorize the lines, there is a kind of sameness to many of them. I'm not putting that down, mind you, It's called product.
When you were playing the roles that you describe as the straight arrows in movies that you've described as not being very good, what kind of role were you dying to play?
I don't know. I don't think I really ever knew what kind of role. I know what kind of role I was dying to play. It's what I'm doing now in the comedy, Naked Gun. And I love comedy. Today in my career, I'm doing what I love to do, and that is do things for the fun. Do comedy. It's a pleasure to go for the laughter.
What are some of the scenes that your fans quote most when they meet you?
Well, they quote lines from Naked Gun. I can't tell you how many times I've heard, "Well, Shirley, you can take a step over here," or "Don't call me Shirley," or "Good luck to you. I want you to know we're all counting on you." And "Hospital, what is it?" These are punchline, or "Well," or "Hey, Ernesto Palacio."
when you took on the role of Lieutenant Frank Drebin, did you actually? This isn't the kind of role where you'd understudy cops. This is the kind of role where you'd watch your old movies, right?
That's, yeah, right, sure, yeah.
Okay, what kinds of talks did you have with the director about how to play it?
Well, David Zucker, I used to discuss scenes with him, and he says, "No, you just go ahead and do it. You're Frank Drebin." And I used to walk away. I wouldn't admit at that time to him that I was wondering what he meant, "I'm Frank Drebin." because I was not Frank Drebin. I mean, I was Leslie Nielsen, and I went away, and I left that character in the studio when I went back. I was am a sophisticated man of the world, almost a Renaissance man. Frank Drebin is dumb and stupid. And I have now, through the last two or three years, come to realize that I'm just as dumb and stupid as Frank Drebin. As a matter of fact, Frank Drebin and I are together constantly now. But I had separated the two of us. And so now it's just, I'm just playing myself.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leslie Nielsen, and he has a new book called The Naked Truth, His Uncensored, Uninhibited, and Totally Made-Up Life Story.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from, because, you know, I think it's like infiltration from some other publishing firm, because everything in this book is true except for the facts, and I've said that time and time again.
Right.
Yes.
Let's see what real biographical facts we can dig up. Many of your fans may not realize that A, you're from Canada,
yeah.
And B, your brother in Canada has been a member of parliament and, I believe, deputy prime minister as well?
That's true. And he finally came to his senses and, you know, just left politics. Thank God for that.
When did he leave?
About two or three years ago.
I guess you turned out real different, huh? He's also very conservative.
Well, he's a conservative politician, yes, but he's not, dyed in the wool. It's a very strange kind of liberality that he does. I don't know. It's when you come from the north, close to the Arctic Circle, you are dealing with concerns and that have to do with people. That's all that counts up in the north, because that's the only way you can get along with ice.
How far up north are you from?
Fort Norman is the place where I spent my childhood, and that is on the same parallel of latitude as Fairbanks in Alaska.
Brr.
It's pretty cold, you know. It gets 70 below zero.
So what kind of house did you live in?
Literally a log cabin. It was built out of logs. And in many cases up in the north, you find log cabins like that with the sod roof and the mud and straw and manure kind of plaster that's put in between the cracks of the logs and to use as a sealer, I guess, for the cabin itself. And in many cases, there was never a floor in the cabins. There was just that heavy, hard-packed gumbo clay, which was like cement, actually, when it was properly tended to.
Boy, you could have really given your children the lecture about, I grew up in a log cabin where I was cold all the time, and so on and so on.
Well, yeah, I suppose you can, but that becomes pretty boring to your kids. My father used to talk all the time about how he'd go out on the milk wagon when he lived in Denmark, and he would get the equivalent of 25 cents for a 10-hour day, and he'd bring the money back and give it to his mother. And so we reached the point where we'd hear this story several times, and you start to say, oh, my, isn't that nice? You had to pick your time to do that, incidentally, because you could end up flying across the room.
Right. Now, your father was in the mounted police.
That's right, yeah.
So have you ever thought about him while you were playing cop roles?
I did a two-hour movie called Shadow Over Elveron. It was a small-town sheriff who really ran the town and was quite a cruel man and very forceful. And I remember playing the role through, and my father saw it, and there was a telephone call. And he says, well, I saw the show. And I said, yeah? He says, well, I guess I know who you modeled that character after. And I was even walking the way he walked, you know. I just did everything the way I remembered he did. And so, yes, there have been certainly times that my experiences with the police work my father did, they came in very handy.
He wasn't cruel, was he?
No. It's hard to define being cruel because, you know, sometimes when you're living in that kind of austere climate up in the north, sometimes you really have to whack somebody pretty hard to bring them to their senses, because if they don't do something, they're liable to freeze to death or die by some other mysterious means, you know. Sometimes you have to be very forceful to get your point home, to keep somebody alive, literally.
So I don't imagine there were a whole lot of movie theaters where you grew up.
There were none at all. You know, there were no churches and no schools either. That's how we had to come out of the north to go to school. My two older brothers were school age. I was still younger, or young enough not to go to school. And so we had to come south to find a place that had a school.
Where'd you go?
north of Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, a place called Thorhild. And they had a three-room schoolhouse.
And did they have any movie theaters?
No, but we had a guy who came by once a month, maybe. He'd drive in and put the sign up that there was going to be a movie at the community hall that was built while I was there, incidentally. And it would be on some day of that particular month. We might have gotten a film six times a year.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Leslie Nielsen, and he's written a new book called The Naked Truth, His Uncensored, Uninhibited, and Totally Made-Up Life Story.
Everything in it is the truth,
except the facts. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Leslie Nielsen is my guest. His new book is called The Naked Truth. Well, I think your first break in show business was working on the radio.
In Calgary, Alberta, right, yeah. I wanted to be either an aeronautical engineer or a radio announcer.
Close.
And I don't know why I said engineer. I guess maybe I thought that was the thing to do. But I did become a radio announcer. Went to Lorne Greene's radio school eventually in Toronto and then down to New York City here, and
let's slow down so we could get the full impact of Lorne Greene's radio school in Canada. He had a radio school, he taught you what there?
He taught me announcing, Lorne Greene's Academy of Radio Arts, and and we took writing and directing and sound effects and all the things that have to pertain to radio. He had a very good school.
Well, did you feel provincial when you got to New York? You'd been in Toronto
provincial
for a while.
Provincial is not the word for it. I felt like a fish out of water. Uh-huh. I was not a hillbilly. I was a snowbilly. And I came down, you know, from a town. Thwart Norman had a dozen people. Thorhild had 75 people. This is what I was used to.
Oh, wow.
And you come to New York City, yeah. I mean, the cosmopolitan city of the world, with guys coming up with wristwatches on their arms and flashing them and wanting to sell you and give you a good deal, and, you know, you're the proverbial sucker born every minute. My only defense was that I looked like I knew what I was doing, and I looked like I belonged where I did belong, no matter how much I felt I didn't. And
were you consciously faking it, or did you just look?
Yeah, well, I just shut up. You know, if you keep quiet and don't say anything, nobody can find out how dumb you are. And it's because I looked like I wasn't dumb. So that was my saving grace.
Now, I was surprised to read that you had also studied dance with Martha Graham when you went to
Well, it's part of the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Oh, I see.
They had Martha Graham was a friend of Mrs. Morgenthau, who I believe had founded the Playhouse. And so she was kind enough to teach us modern dance. I did not know who Martha Graham was.
You see, it just seems so out of character for me to think of all the airplane pilot and the cops that you've played, you know, doing modern dance with Martha Graham.
Well, I agree with you. I felt the same way. But the second year, it dawned on me, you know, who Martha Graham and dancing and so on. They had those kind of a blue jersey outfit they put on you with bell-bottom trousers and this was the kind of uniform you wore on any modern dance presentation. And, you know, I was used to cowboys and Indians and shoot 'em up and Tarzan and swinging from the trees, not this, running across with the piano music and doing hoppity-hippity and skippity-scoppity and so on. But the second year, I buckled down and really tried very hard to learn modern dance and to be part of it. And I'm very grateful that I did, too.
So you got to really like it.
Yes, I did. But also, you know, to have the benefit of being taught by such an extraordinary artist as Martha Graham.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't know anybody, and I didn't know about anything. So, as you said earlier, I had a lot of catching up to do.
When you look back on your career now, does it look completely different to you than it did before Naked Gun and Airplane?
Well, it's terribly different now. It's very different now. How can I put it? Things, fortunately for me, have not turned out to be as important as I used to think they were. My big break has not been, although Airplane I think was a break, meeting Jerry and David and Jim, but my big break began that very day that I woke up and decided I would no longer take myself seriously. And so.
What day was that?
Well, it was a day, and I can't pin it down. It was 20 years ago, maybe, somewhere like that.
Oh, when you were still doing straight films?
Well, yeah, doing comedy too. Well, doing straight films, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. When you say you decided not to take yourself seriously, did you think you'd been taking yourself too seriously?
Yes, I think so. You know, when you have important things to do, those in many cases are, I think, the way we defend ourselves against our feelings of insecurity.
Would you still like to do drama?
Sure. I do the one-man play, Darrow.
Oh, I didn't
The Life
that.
Of Clarence Darrow, and I admire the man so much, and I love the play, and one day I will do it again. And also, one day down the line, I'd like to do Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. But, you know, the disclaimer is that I don't have any ambition and I do not have any goals, so I may not do them.
That's refreshing.
Yeah, right. I'm happy. You know, I like people, and I like hanging out with the people I love, and... That's the name of the game for me right now. I hate avarice and greed, which includes people like stockbrokers, junk bonds, and things like that.
How did you do the condom scene in Naked Gun?
Very gently. You know what happened with that scene was that in the beginning we had a kind of a material on the condom that you could, you know, really kind of see through. It was translucent or not opaque, you know. And the scene didn't work. It just didn't. It was not funny. And eventually David figured it out, and he had them remake the condom, but so that you could see the outline, but you could not see anybody inside the condom. You could see the outline of the body and so on. And then it worked. And I think what happened when it didn't work was that people were spending a great deal of time trying to look through the condom to see Priscilla or to see whatever. And it was a very funny scene.
You want to describe the scene?
Describe the scene?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we have this wonderful candlelit dinner. And eventually it's apparent to Priscilla the enormous attraction she has for me as I for her. And we stand up and the clothes literally fall off our bodies as she says, I believe in safe sex, and I say, so do I. And the next scene at the window in the bedroom, you see these shadowy images in an embrace, and you see these two giant condoms with the nipples on their heads as they maneuver and fall toward the bed. And the camera pans down, and you see something that looks like it's 3 feet by 3 feet, and it's obviously a giant condom package.
It's Leslie Nielsen, and he has a new book called The Naked Truth. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Hey, who are you?
I'm Lieutenant Frank Drebin, police squad. And don't ever let me catch you guys in America.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Harry Shearer, The Early Days. Shearer is a satirist whose work is heard on All Things Considered and his own program, Le Show. He's the voice of Mr. Burns and many other characters on The Simpsons. He's also a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. We'll talk with him about his days as a child actor, working with Jack Benny, Mel Blanc, and Abbott and Costello. And world music commentator Milo Miles tells us about the late guitarist and singer Joseph Spence. This Bahamian musician was a cult hero to many folk revivalists of the 60s. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Mideast peace talks resume tomorrow in Washington. Most of the attention will be focused elsewhere, though, as Israeli and Palestinian negotiators await final approval of Israel's accord with the PLO. Israel and Syria do have a chance, however, to make some headway on their negotiations. Barry Schweit has more.
In the next 3 days of scheduled peace talks in Washington, Israel and Syria are likely to get into the heart of their dispute. Syria's demand for recovery of the Golan Heights and Israel's demand for a comprehensive peace treaty with Syria. The two sides have worked on side issues, and the momentum of Israel's pact with the PLO could prod them toward progress on the land for peace front. Syria's stance also could be a clue to Syria's ultimate decision on Israel's agreement with the PLO on Palestinian self-rule in Gaza and in Jericho. Syrian President Hafez Assad is taking a cautious approach, on the one hand not interfering with the Palestinians' decision, but also withholding endorsement out of deference to more radical Palestinian factions with which Syria has close ties. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
10 Palestinian groups today circulated a leaflet in the Israeli-occupied territories calling PLO leader Yasser Arafat corrupt and saying he no longer represents the Palestinian people. The groups that distributed the document are based in Syria. They oppose Arafat's draft agreement with Israel on Palestinian self-rule. The southern Indiana region held its 107th annual Labor Day celebration today, one of the nation's oldest and largest. Trish Muse of member station WNIN reports the state's striking coal miners highlighted this year's parade.
United Mine Workers of America President Richard Trumka and more than 4,000 miners marched through Evansville streets earlier today in a parade that came in the midst of a coal strike, which since May 10th has pitted 17,000 miners in seven states, including Indiana, against some of the nation's largest coal producers. UMW member Bill Yockey says miners are prepared to stay out one day longer than coal operators are.
I've been a miner for 25 years and we haven't lost one yet.
Thousands attended today's parade in Evansville, which sits in the heart of the Illinois Basin coal region that includes southwestern Indiana, southeastern Illinois, and western Kentucky. For National Public Radio, I'm Trish Muse in Evansville, Indiana.
A jury in West Palm Beach, Florida, has started deliberations in the case of two white men charged with setting a black tourist on fire last January. In closing arguments today, the defense told the jury to put emotions aside and concentrate on the evidence, which it claimed was lacking. Prosecutors pointed to the testimony of the burning victim, Christopher Wilson, who identified his attackers. The prosecution said the accused showed no respect for human life. If convicted, the two men could face life in prison. This is NPR News. President Clinton visited South Florida today to check up on the rebuilding there 1 year after Hurricane Andrew. After touring devastated areas of Florida City, Mr. Clinton praised Floridians for their successes, and he said he hopes their recovery encourages people in the flooded Midwest. Fierce clashes are reported today between Muslim and Croat forces in Bosnia. The Muslims are apparently trying to seal off Croat supply lines. Meanwhile, Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic says, despite the breakdown of the Geneva peace talks, his forces will continue to honor a ceasefire in Bosnia. The BBC's Jim Muir reports from Sarajevo.
Having seized the political high ground by accepting the latest peace plan without qualifications, Mr. Karadzic is clearly taking full advantage of the opportunity to play the part of sweetness and reason. Contrary to predictions, he said, the breakdown of the Geneva talks had not led to an escalation of fighting between the Bosnian Serbs and the Muslim-led government forces, though battles had been taking place between the Muslims and the Croats. The Bosnian Serbs, he said, were concerned to maintain the ceasefire. They did not need more land, they would not launch any new attacks, and they were ready to withdraw from a significant amount of the territory they currently hold. They would, Mr. Karadzic said, wait patiently for the Muslim side to come back to the negotiating table, and only once they had given up hope of the others accepting the current plan would the Serbs seek recognition for their own mini-republic.
Jim Muir in Sarajevo. In a message on Sarajevo radio today, Bosnia's Muslim President Alija Izetbegovic said his forces would also observe the ceasefire. Izetbegovic is in New York City. He'll speak to the UN Security Council tomorrow. The president told Bosnian reporters today he'll demand more territory for Bosnian Muslims than the 30% share of the country under the Geneva peace proposal. Nigerian oil workers ended their strike today that had paralyzed the country with fuel shortages. The protest began in late August, grounding domestic air flights. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Harry Shearer is one of the sharpest political satirists around. You can hear his work on All Things Considered and on his own radio program, Le Show. You probably also know his voice as the voice of several characters on The Simpsons, including Mr. Burns and Principal Skinner. Shearer has parodied heavy metal musicians in his portrayal of bass player Derek Smalls in Spinal Tap, and he's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live. He's very good at spoofing the world of show business. He first entered that world as a child actor. When I spoke with him last spring, he was about to do a career retrospective at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. I knew he had been in the pilot of Leave It to Beaver, but I wasn't sure what role he played.
Eddie Haskell?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You were Eddie Haskell?
Yeah.
Oh, he told me you were Eddie Haskell's friend. You were Eddie Haskell. You were the obnoxious friend.
Yeah.
What happened? You didn't get the part?
My parents took the position that it was fine for me to work on TV and radio as a child, but they didn't want me being in a series. I think their reasoning was that it would take me out of school. I was going to, like, regular public school, and then when I'd get a job, I'd go work and come back to school. If you're in a series, you're just in that world forever. You know, you never go back to public school, and you're on the set all the time. I now realize later, with the hindsight that I've accumulated in show business, that it's also not a good idea for a 9- or 10-year-old kid to have, you know, 200 guys on the crew standing around going, kid looks off this week. You know, their paycheck is dependent on a 9-year-old and the pressure of those guys watching. Kids losing the cuteness a little bit here. What's happening? You know, you don't want that. So I'm very glad that happened.
You'd have to be in a self-help group now for...
for aging child stars.
Exactly,
yeah.
I mean, they all have such problems.
Yeah. Not that I don't have problems, Terry, but...
Well, at least they're different problems.
That's right.
I know when I was growing up, a lot of times when there were child actors... And some of what I'm thinking is, of course, from films that were made a little earlier. But a lot of the child actors, the male child actors, were in short pants and were really whiny and obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to play that type of person?
No. Because I was dark-haired, I basically played like Italian street kids, you know, who had to be rescued from a life of having a gangland name attached to them by the time they were, you know. Get this kid and save him before somebody starts calling him the chin, you know, parts like that. There's a lot of typecasting with children, you know, and if you're blonde or redheaded and freckle-faced, why, you get different parts than if you're dark-haired.
Did you ever play anybody Jewish?
Ostensibly Jewish? No, I don't think so.
I don't think there were many ostensibly Jewish characters.
About the only one I guess would have been if people knew I played Jack Benny as a child. A couple times on his show, and if they figured out that Jack Benny was Jewish, then they might have figured out that I was playing a Jewish character.
Was Jack Benny nice to you?
He was the greatest. I did his show a lot. After the third time I did his radio show, he came out into the hallway behind the studio after the show was over, gave me this huge hug, and gave me a transcription of the show that we just finished. And it was just, from then on, it was he was so... warm and kind to me. He was very generous, very smart, very generous in the sense of liking the fact, not just allowing the people around him to get laughs, but really liking the fact that the supporting players on his program got laughs. I remember vividly the first time I made him laugh in a rehearsal. We were reading the script and sitting around a table, and I ad-libbed a little thing. And I mean, I was a kid. I was, you know, 8 or 9 years old, and to see Jack Benny not just laugh, but, I mean, laugh uproariously and hit the table was so amazing.
What did you say? I mean, what did you say that got him laughing?
I was playing, the Beverly Hills Beavers were doing their version of Jack Benny's radio show, so I was playing Sheldon Leonard, the guy who played the racetrack. Hey, bud, come here a minute. I got to hit the... I forget exactly what I said. I may have just... It may have just been something I did with my voice. I don't know, but I mean, I remember I did a little something, and all of a sudden Jack Benny is like hitting, you know, pounding the table laughing. It was easy for him to be generous in giving the supporting players around him laughs, because he always knew he could get a great laugh by reacting to them. That said, a lot of people in show business, a lot of people in comedy, aren't that smart to know that they can always get a good laugh by reacting and get very jealous of people around them getting any laughs at all. He was also one of the first people I knew who owned his own show.
Oh.
Very smart guy.
For just joining us, my guest is Harry Shearer, and Harry has a new book called Man Bites Town. That's a collection of columns that he used to write for the magazine of the Los Angeles Times. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Harry Shearer. You might have told me this before in another interview, I'm not sure, but how...
I never repeat myself, Terry.
I never asked a question twice. How did you get started as an actor at so young an age?
I had a piano teacher starting from when I was four, and I like to think that I helped her make the decision to have a career change. And she decided to become a children's agent, and partly because she had a child of her own who was working in show business, so she had those connections. And she said to my parents, for reasons best known to her, do you mind if I try to get Harry some work? And they said, sure. And 7 or 8 months went by, and it was sort of like a family joke. Have we heard from Mrs. McMillan yet? No. And then she called up one day and said, there's an audition for the Jack Benny Show. And I went in and got it.
So that was your first part?
That was my first thing I did in show business, yeah.
And when was Beaver in relation to that?
It was about 3 years later. I think I was 10.
You know, when I was growing up, I thought, like, well, if I really reach that pinnacle, I'll be able to meet someone from the Mickey Mouse Club and befriend them. You know, I mean, I just thought, like, wow, wouldn't it be swell to know somebody was actually on television?
Mm.
And what was it like for you to actually be on the box?
Well, I really loved that world. I mean, it was an escape from what I found to be the incredibly boring world of my fellow children. So any time I could go into that world, it was just, hey, this is where I want to be. You know, it was cool. I got to school was wrapped up, pardon me, in like 3 hours. You'd have the tutor on the set, and they'd do school real fast to get you ready for work. And then you were either working, and that was fun, or you'd sit around, you know, reading the trades and eating good food for lunch at the commissary and hanging around with grown-ups, you know? It was so hip. I loved it.
Who were some of the people who took you under their wing or tried to introduce you to things that kids weren't supposed to be introduced to? A lot of adults really take pride in doing that.
Well, I my best memory in terms of a guy who took me under his wing, and it's either ironic or fitting given what I've been doing in later life, was Mel Blanc. Who was the great voice genius of the Warner Brothers cartoons and was also one of the regulars in the Jack Benny Show. And I'll never forget, it was very early on in my career on the Benny Show, but my parents always used to sit upstairs. This was the radio show, and there were two booths. There was a control room behind glass where the crew sat, you know, the technical crew. And there was a booth upstairs also behind glass where the sponsors sat and where, you know, guests could sit too. It was called the client's booth. And my parents would always sit there. They'd watch me from above. And I could always get eye contact with them by looking up there. And one show they decided, we're going to go see what it looks like from out in the audience. So they do that. And before the show begins, Don Wilson, we're all standing out in the hallway, and Don Wilson, the announcer of the show, introduces every cast member to the audience. And so when you hear Don Wilson call your name, you walk into the studio, take a bow, and sit down. And we're standing out in the hallway talking, and I hear, Harry! And I open the door and walk in. And instead of getting my little usual smattering of applause, I get a huge laugh. And I, you know, I think I probably looked down to check my zipper, and that was okay, and sat down, and Mel Blanc was sitting there next to me. He'd already been introduced, and he said, explained to me that the reason they were laughing was because Don Wilson hadn't been introducing me. He'd been calling Mary from Mary Livingston. And I was, you know, destroyed. I couldn't find my parents anywhere. They were out in the audience where I couldn't see him. And he was just, you know, he made it possible for me to go on that night. But he was very sweet and kind to me all the way through the time that I knew him on the Benny Show.
What did he do that made you feel better?
Just, you know, talk to me about, you know, it was funny and it's not a bad thing to get a laugh. And, you know, that they're not down on me because of it. And I didn't screw up the show and, you know, explained all the things that a child at that point might be afraid that he'd done, which I was.
Your parents, I believe, were immigrants from Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
What did they make of you being in the middle of American popular culture when they were so new to the culture?
I think they were proud. It got them into a world that they would never have experienced otherwise. You know, they were, I think they were, the thing that amazed them most was the other parents of the kids, you know. They would look around at the behavior of these other parents of kids and just shake their heads in amazement that people could be like this with their kids and with other grown-ups, you know. It, as we were talking before, you know, the parents of a lot of child actors have some serious problems and very often force the kids into the business, and you see that behavior close at hand, and I think that shocked them more than anything else.
Where were they from?
My mom is from Poland, and my dad was from Austria.
And what did they do for a living?
Well, you know, as immigrants, they did what they had to. That's not to say they violated any laws. My dad had trained as an opera singer, and he ran a gas station. And my mom had been educated as an accountant and ended up being a restaurant bookkeeper.
Right. Okay, let's continue our procession through your early acting career.
Okay.
Any other TV shows I should know about from the early days, from Harry Shearer, the early days?
Probably the most significant other ones I did were Alfred Hitchcock and Ann Southern.
Ann Southern, where she was the secretary?
Yeah, yeah. That was one where I was like a bad kid whom she rescues from the streets. And the most prestigious show I ever did, in the early days of television, there was this wonderful Sunday afternoon program called Omnibus, which sort of was an all-purpose arts show that covered the waterfront. And I did that once when Jack Benny was recreating his historic flop movie, The Horn Blows at Midnight. But I did, you know, an awful lot of what was going on at that time in television.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were on GE Theater, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the one Ronald Reagan hosted?
Yeah, it sure was. Mm-hmm. During it was, he'd not only host it, but he'd go out to the GE plants all over the country and do the thing with the light bulb and such.
Did you meet him?
No.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, what a shame. He came in and did all his stuff, you know, at one time. You know, he'd host 20 shows at a crack and then go off and do his touring of the...
do the hello and say the fellas, you're making good light bulbs, keep it up. You know, do that.
Oh, gee, I'm so disappointed that you didn't meet him. You could have started studying him at an early age.
At an early age. You can't study people at an early age. I have a very distinct memory of being on the radio with partners of mine and talking about the people who were difficult to do. And at the time, Reagan was governor of California, and we agreed that he was one of the most difficult people to do. But as public figures get older, possibly because they learn what it is that works and keep doing that, they increasingly become caricatures of themselves. And so they save you the effort. You don't have to caricature them. You just do them. And he became incredibly easy to do as time went on. I think that that's, you know, that they all have handlers and advisors who tell them, do this. This is what works. And that's what sort of makes them narrower and narrower as people and easier to do as a result.
Mm-hmm. What was the last time that you had an acting role, you know, as a young person?
I was 15. It was probably a Benny show or a series that was on called at that time called TV Reader's Digest, in which I guess they took stories from the magazine and condensed them further for television.
Well, that sounds exciting.
Yeah. For people for whom the Reader's Digest was tough reading.
Was this a conscious effort to give up the business?
Yeah, I made it. I retired from the business at the age of 15 because I was starting college, and I thought, I breezed my way through school, and I thought, well, college I'm going to have to take seriously. And about the first week I got there, I went to work for the school paper, and there went that notion.
So what got you back into show business?
Trying jobs that weren't in show business.
Trying and failing?
No, not failing, just not liking them as much as I like show business.
Uh-huh.
I taught school for a couple of years. I wrote journalism. I wrote advertising. I worked at the state legislature in California. And when I had the opportunity to do this stuff again, I thought, yeah, more fun.
Satirist Harry Shearer. You can hear him on All Things Considered and on his own radio program, Le Show. He's also the author of the recent book, Man Bites Town, a collection of columns he wrote for the Los Angeles Times magazine. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we'll be following the president's Labor Day trip to Florida. The president is preparing to issue a report on reinventing government, and we'll talk to the author of that report. We have a hilarious tour of the radio dial to save all our listeners the trouble of ever answering the unhealthy impulse to change stations. We have updates from Somalia, from Sarajevo, where Scott Simon is, and the gathering of NPR reporters in the Middle East has begun. We'll have a report from Jackie Lydon in Jordan. Also, we have an essay on the value of manual labor. That's later today on All Things Considered.
World music commentator Milo Miles has an appreciation of the late guitarist and singer Joseph Spence. He was a unique stylist from the Bahamas who became a cult hero during the folk revival of the 60s. Though his records were steady sellers and he was a major influence on performers such as Ry Cooder, Spence's music hasn't received much attention of late, particularly since his death in 1984. Almost everything he recorded has now been reissued on CD, and Milo says it's high time for a Joseph Spence revival.
Unrolling seven Jesus speak to me. Unrolling seven and roll. Unrolling seven Jesus speak to me.
Most often I talk about new types of world music formed when distinct cultures meet. And this is only right because the earth is increasingly a place of intersections and less a place with blind alleys, truly isolated spots. But there's no doubt isolation and exceptional talent can produce fresh styles of music. One of the best examples of all time is Joseph Spence. Music folklorist Sam Charters encountered Spence in 1958 on Andros, the sparsely inhabited island where Spence was born in 1910. As Charters put it, anyone who goes looking for undiscovered music with a tape recorder dreams of meeting performers so vibrant their songs will affect anyone who hears them. Well, what made Spence so striking? The first thing that amazes a newcomer about him is his vocalizing. It's a deep, percolating mixture of growls, gulps, falsetto scat, and snatches of lyrics, mostly intended to help Spence keep track of where he is in a song, but it communicates vividly anyway. But it was budding folk guitarists who were bowled over by Spence. He plays like no one else. His inflection is immensely percussive. Indeed, his guitar is a new kind of drum, with each note a dab of beat. With many abrupt rhythm and harmony changes, his delivery has a wondrous tumbling forward, out of control and yet in control feeling. His renditions of songs have been compared to improvised jazz, but if so, it must be a Bahama brand of free jazz, because the only kind of changes Spence makes are his own. Finally, it's worth noting that Spence was a profoundly religious man, with the same kind of tension between the sinful and the sacred that animates the Reverend Gary Davis and Thomas A. Dorsey. In Spence's hands, the most shop-worn hymn becomes an occasion for joy, mystery, and portent. Spence's work appears on CDs by Folkways, Arhuli, Rounder, Nonesuch, and Hannibal. I would recommend the Near Instrumentals on the Complete Folkways Recordings 1958. And then Happy All the Time on Hannibal. The several collections where he sings with the Pindar family are rough going for me. They're just too loose, but infectious fun nonetheless. And stiffness in Spence's fingers made his playing less fluid after the 1960s. Who knows, though, you may want to get everything he made. Danged if even his multiple versions of the same songs aren't downright fascinating.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed new CD reissues of music by Joseph Spence. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. I'm Terry Gross. Happy holiday. Next Fresh Air, making an elementary school work in the poorest and most dangerous part of Philadelphia. We talk with Madeline Cartwright about her decade as a principal. After she organized parents to help her clean up the school and get rid of the roaches and rodents, she brought in a washing machine and dryer so the kids could always have clean clothes. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the Next Fresh Air.